You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Oh, Don, the weather is so perfect.
It is. We're going to be apparently 90 degrees today, June 24, as we prepare the show for broadcast on June 25. We're officially in summer now. This is the first Davis Garden Show of the summer, and the weather this week is going to be below average temperature all week. Average high on this date, according to weatherspark.com, would be 91, I think is what I just found.
And 89,
you're right. And we gradually go up to about 93 as our average high as we get into July and August. Well, this week's high temperatures, I'll just read right through them. 89, 85, 81 on Saturday, 87 on Sunday. Monday is going to be 91 and Tuesday is going to be 88. Night temperatures in the mid 50s. In fact, it was a little chilly last night. It was mom sweater weather last night. 56 degrees tonight, 58 degrees, 57, 56, 56, 59, and 58 are the low temperatures for the coming week. We are going to be pretty gusty wind from the south Thursday night. So that's a, let's call it a delta breeze. It's going to be like 20 miles an hour. So we can call that more than a breeze if you wish, but kind of windy, kind of cool, great planting weather. I can tell you that seedlings that I'm putting in right now, pumpkins and things like that, they aren't even drooping. You put them in, you water them, they don't even look like they've been stressed at all when they get planted in this kind of weather. So absolutely perfect planting weather right now for anything you're thinking about doing, whether it's flowers, vegetables, perennials, shrubs, trees, things like that. And yes, I'm saying it's okay to plant shrubs and trees and things like that going into the summer, as long as you can give them the proper aftercare, the watering that they need. But for your vegetable garden, for your flower garden, for containers, things like that, fantastic planting weather. Temperatures in the mid to upper 80s all week and finally breaking 90. I think Weather Underground has us going to 91 degrees middle of next week, and that's the only time we're going to be breaking 90 really in the next several days. Looking back, Lois and I were debating how many days over 100 we had had so far this year.
And I thought it was three, because when we look at the weather forecast in the morning and it says it's going to be 101, mm-hmm. I believe them. Yep. But if it doesn't make it that high, it's only at 99, I won't know that.
That's correct. We got to 101. In fact, on June 12th, we were 97 the day before and 98, almost 99 the day after. And that's it. It's June 24th, and we've barely broken 100 degrees once so far. So we've had some periods of higher temperature way back when. Remember back in March when we had all that high temperature? Very cool temperatures in parts of May and June. This is having some impact. It's not adverse. I don't hear a lot of people complaining about it, but I have had feedback that early fruit, early stone fruit, peaches, nectarines, just don't have the flavor. And in some cases, they're pretty awful. And I thought, well, that's interesting anecdotally. Then someone sent me an email about something else and said, hey, have you heard that, you know, nectarine, my early nectarine was just terrible and had these pit issues? Then Ed Livo, who I have enormous respect for, Ed's been a fruit tree nursery industry consultant for as long as I can remember, made an offhand comment, one of his Facebook comments, that yes, we are hearing that the early fruited stone fruits just aren't there in terms of flavor and quality this year. Well, that's almost certainly temperature related. So there's sometimes a downside to wonderful balmy planting weather. That would be one of them, is possibly an effect on the early fruit. I think it's safe to say we'll warm up, but within the next week, barely going to do that. So it's going to be great planting weather right on through the next several days. Katie, are
And
you?
Don keeps saying Ed Livo, and I want you to know that you can go to his Facebook page and see wonderful, wonderful posts that he has.
Yeah.
It's E L A I V O. That's his Facebook page. LLAIVO.
Ed worked for Dave Wilson Nursery for a long time, worked for Four Winds Growers, has been a consultant to the nursery industry and to home gardeners. And actually, he's now a master gardener. I see that on his page. One thing I like is every 3 or 4 days, he posts very informative comments. You know, he's actually using social media like it's supposed to be used. I'm looking at June 12th. I'm at Ron Vanderhelm's You Pick Orchard discussing the pros and cons of growing Royal Blenheim apricot. And he goes on with some information about the Royal Blenheim apricot. Now, interesting fact about that one, side note, despite its limited adaptability, it's very well adapted here in apricot country. The Royal Blenheim's reputation remains as strong today as when it was introduced in the early 1900s. Whether you know it, this is the reason I'm reading this, as Blenheim Royal or Royal Blenheim, this iconic apricot remains a benchmark for flavor and a fascinating challenge for home gardeners and orchardists alike. It is all the same variety. I have received Blenheim apricot labeled Blenheim. I say it that way because although we mostly say Blenheim, it's spelled Blenheim. I've also received it labeled Royal, and the company that I used to get them from had the exact same picture on both tags. And sometimes they call it Royal Blenheim. That was a marketing term. It's all the same variety. What makes it a challenge for home gardeners is that it doesn't grow outside of the California Central Valley real well. So this is one, if you're listening in another area, you might want to ask locally if this is one that'll do well for you. It is early ripening. It does have good quality in this area. It's in fact got, in my opinion, the very best flavor of any apricot. But you need to pick it green. If you wait until it's fully golden ripe on the tree, the texture will be very unappealing and it may well have already begun to spoil around the pit. So you need to pick it as it's turning color. Let it sit on your counter for a couple of days. Squeeze it a little bit as you walk by. Wait until it's softened just a bit, and you'll have probably the best apricot you've ever had in your life. So thank you, Ed Livo, for highlighting the Blenheim apricot and all the other great stuff you put on your page there. And I do appreciate your feedback on the early fruit and some of the stone fruit, not apricots, but the nectarines and peaches just not being up to quality. If we don't have the heat, they don't have the sugar content. And in some cases, they don't have the acidity that balances that sugar content and gives them more oomph in their flavor. So hopefully this is just a one-off, but it's almost certainly temperature related.
Apricot oomph.
Apricot oomph, yes. If a fruit is just sweet, let's take the jujube, Chinese date. It's one of the highest Brix contents of any fruit you can get. Brix meaning a measure of the soluble solids, so it's a proxy for the content of sugar. Some people love Chinese date. I bite into one, it's like this is just a thing of sugar. But fruit, if it doesn't have some acidity, will to me and to most people actually be bland. The sugar is not the entire thing. Some people, that's all they care about. And I remember going to fruit tastings at Dave Wilson Nursery many years ago and sitting next to a guy, and we were tasting peaches and nectarines. The only ones he liked the whole time we were there were the white peaches that were super sweet. Everything else, he kept saying, these aren't ripe. And but they're ripe, they just have acidity. Acidity is a part of the balance of a flavor profile that any fruit has. To me, Blenheim has that right balance. It's got the sweetness of an apricot, but it also has a little bit of a bite to it with the acidity, which I think is important. If you prefer nectarines to peaches, it's probably because of the slightly higher acidity that most nectarines have as part of their flavor profile. That was a digression I did not mean to get into. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you're hearing, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. Well, you're over there. Check out some of the other great programming here at KDRT. We have lots of music shows, but we also have some great public affairs programming. Some of it is very local. I would say hyper local is the YOLO Backyard Bulletin, which features local news, commentary, music, gossip. True stories from Yolo County with the goal of rebuilding and restoring community communications in our public sphere, the lifeblood of democratic life. It is 5 to 6 p.m. every Thursday evening here at KDRT, and it is, of course, live streaming at kdrt.org. So check out the YOLO Backyard Bulletin, Thursdays at 5 here at KDRT. Now, you went traveling.
I did. We went up to Clear Lake, and we had such a nice time up there. I don't know if you all know where Clear Lake is. If you go in California Central Valley and you head north on I-5 and you get to a little town called Williams. Well, then you turn left and you go uphill to the west on Highway 20 and it goes up and then it starts winding back and forth. And eventually there's this giant lake. It's called Clear Lake. And if you keep going on Highway 20, eventually you get to the ocean and you can go to the Mendocino Botanical Gardens, which we didn't do on this trip, but that's where that is. Anyway, Clear Lake is huge and it's deep and it has a giant population of Western grebe and Clark's grebe. And grebe is spelled G-R-E-B-E in case you want to look it up. They're beautiful diving birds, and we saw the babies and all. It's always very nice. They have osprey, and in fact, the communities around there like their osprey, so they put up giant poles with a platform on top so that the osprey have some place to make their nests, which does two things. One, it encourages them to have nests, and two, it keeps them off of the telephone poles. I think that's why these platforms got started.
All right. So that brings us to our major public service announcement for the beginning of the summer vacation season. This is really simple. It's three words. Don't move firewood. So let's assume that Lois and family went over to Clear Lake and decided to stay in a cabin and that there was a fire pit out there and they went and bought some firewood there at the campground or wherever and they piled it up and they made a fire and they enjoyed that and they roasted some marshmallows. The next day they look and half the firewood is still there and they're moving on to another campground. Maybe they're going to drive over to the coast. Maybe they're going to go further up the coast or further into the valley. Don't take that firewood with you. This is the most important thing we can say in Northern California right now in your camping summer vacation season. Mediterranean oak borer, which is one of the borers that is killing our valley oaks, is well established around Clear Lake, a number of sites of infestation around Clear Lake. And this came in through Marin County originally about 8 or 10 years ago. Last summer, as I was putting together a program to speak to some people about the threats to our urban forest, up popped a news story as I was literally putting my slides together about oak trees that were being removed at Natomas Oaks Park in Sacramento because of the Mediterranean oak borer. This is not the invasive shothole borer, which is a whole separate issue. That's in the Bay Area in San Jose, and there's a similar one in the Felton area of Santa Cruz. So if you're in the coast near San Jose, if you're on the coast near Santa Cruz and you're camping and you buy some firewood to use or you gather it, I don't know where you'd be doing that, but let's say you buy some at your typical campground, pile of the kindling that they sell you. You just leave that there for the next person before you move on. Do not put that in your vehicle and take it with you. That is one way that these wood boring insects are transmitted or moved from one region to another. We're almost certain that's how they're moving around California. Is not, they can fly, but they can't fly from the coast to Clear Lake. They can fly from one part of Clear Lake to another part of Clear Lake. So they were presumably brought in on wood somehow. Mediterranean oak borer is thought to have been brought into California on oak staves used in the wine industry. And so they first showed up over in wine country and then has spread on in and is now present in the Sacramento area, Yolo County, as well as around Clear Lake. I mention this because as I was preparing for this show, probably because I said something about borers and my computer picked it up and decided it was important that I learn about this. Emerald ash borer up in Oregon has spread further within the county, the 5-county region where it's quarantined. A number of new sites in those in that 5-county area have been found infested. Emerald ash borer kills ash trees. When it moves into an area, it kills all of the ash trees. You might think, oh, how big a problem is that? Well, we have several thousand ash trees in Davis. Sacramento has many, many thousands of ash trees. They were widely planted in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, even into the 1980s. So these are older trees that are definitely threatened by the emerald ash borer. This is up in the Willamette Valley, which, as you know, if you know Oregon, is right on Interstate 5. If you're camping up there and you're heading home, you're thinking, oh, I'll just take that firewood home and use it at home in the backyard. Don't do that. Leave it there. Leave the wood wherever you purchased it. Do not take it with you. This is really important. We'll give you more updates on these different borer problems. Invasive shot-hole borer coming up from Southern California, now established around San Jose and also in Felton. Mediterranean red oak borer, the one I'm discussing here. Emerald ash borer coming in from the north and also from the east. All of those are threats to our urban forest. And the simplest thing you can do is not move firewood.
Well, you know, we have events in the community that are very exciting, too. And this one, now, Danny is one of our listeners, and she has written in and said, my parents' farm, which is Bluestone Meadow, is a lavender farm. And they are going to be part of the Lavender Blue Festival happening this weekend, June 27th and 28th in Apple Hill. Now, Apple Hill is on Highway 50, just off Highway 50, near Placerville. So we have a message from a new listener named Jauncey, and she, from the picture, is in a sunny, dry California place.
Yep.
She writes, I enjoy listening to your show. I'm curious if this verbena is considered invasive and if I shouldn't have it on our farm. I always notice bees and hummingbirds on the flowers, and sends a picture of this, well, very interesting plant. Is that verbena inflorescence?
It is verbena. It's verbena bonariensis. And I'm trying to find a common name for this one. Nurseries do sell this. It's a very easy to grow verbena. The key question was,
is it invasive?
Yes. So I get that question a lot. And I have to give one quick answer, which is that invasiveness is very local. So a plant that's invasive in Bodega Bay may or may not be invasive in the Sacramento Valley. And vice versa. But Verbena bonariensis is one that many gardeners have grown and will happily tell you, yes, this reseeds all over my yard. It definitely does that. So it can become a bit of a garden thug, I believe is the term that the British use. You know, Lantana is invasive in New Zealand, but it's not invasive in California anywhere. So this is something we do need to be cautious about, just casually saying something is or is not invasive. But here in California, we have a phenomenal resource. cal-ipc.org, which refers to the Invasive Plants Council. And on that site, they have a link right there in the menu bar for plants. And you can go in there and find, at least for a starting point, is this plant already in their system? Is this something that has been evaluated or is being considered for evaluation as to whether it is invasive?
And if you know a name, they have a search bar on the front of the thing. And so I searched for verbena, and I came up with Verbena bonariensis.
There it is. It's a big plant, tall, interesting branching spikes of flowers, which if you look closely at them and then hold them next to the more familiar ground covering verbena, you will see the relationship. Just for the record, there are now dwarf versions of Verbena bonariensis, which have really caught on with the nursery trade, because whenever a dwarfer version of a 5 foot tall plant comes on the market, obviously, we're going to sell that one since it fits into people's gardens better. So you'll probably see some of these more compact growers if you're out in garden centers shopping for this plant. The common name is tall vervain. Vervain is a common name for verbena, V-E-R-V-A-I-N. And they get to 4 to 5 feet when they're in bloom, and the dwarf versions are only 2 to 3 feet. So that has some advantages right there. There are some comments here about whether or not it is invasive. You can look at the plant risk assessment for it, and you can scroll through that. This was done about 10 years ago, but there are a number of the characteristics that they look at. There are about 13 or 14 characteristics they use to evaluate any of more than that. Excuse me. There's 20 characteristics that they use to evaluate whether a plant has invasive potential. And simple questions like, does the species commonly produce viable seed? Yes or no?
Yes, it does.
Does this plant produce copious viable seeds each year?
Yes, it does.
Yes, it does. Is there significant germination the next growing season?
Yes, there is.
Okay, so is it produced? Hold on here, scrolling down. Are the plant's propagules frequently dispersed long distance by mammals or birds or via domestic animals?
No.
Yes, apparently.
Yes.
Yes. So dispersal can happen. I don't know how, because I don't see anything on that seed that attaches it. But are the plant's propagules frequently dispersed long distance by wind or water? Yes, confidence level is low. So they don't know for sure about that one. So you can scroll through here and go, yeah, this one has invasive potential. I can tell you as a nursery person, it's not on invasive plant lists that I have to worry about. It's not the kind of thing where the CDFA has told ag commissioners you need to regulate this plant, but it definitely does have invasive potential. It's on the watch list up in Washington State, for example. In Georgia, they are concerned about it. So it is becoming invasive in some areas that are not that similar to here, but it is something to be aware of because it does check a lot of boxes for its invasive potential. If you do grow it, watch for seedlings. And you make your own decision pretty quickly about whether this is something you think will be okay wherever you're listening.
So our next message comes from Tara, who is in, where does
Oakland.
Tara live? Oakland.
Oakland.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would like a recommendation for stabilizing a full sun hillside.
Yeah.
We have a very steep hill at the top of a canyon above a nature preserve in Oakland. I'm
Cool.
looking for seed recommendations. I would like to keep with low growing, low water native plants if possible. My challenge challenges include A, this hill is infested with gophers that destabilize the soil and eat certain plants.
Yeah.
B, I'm in a high fire risk area, so I don't want anything taller than 2 feet after it gets established. And C, I don't want to have to water in the future.
Yeah.
It's currently covered with dog hazard foxtails, tall
Yeah.
ones,
Yeah.
and various invasive spiny dandelion
Oh,
things.
I have those.
Scattered a pound of wildflower seeds last fall, but very few took. In my online reading, I thought blue grama might be a good option since Calscape says very low water. However, the Theodore Payne Foundation says moderate water, which leaves me unsure on how to proceed.
Okay, so a
And
couple.
so she puts in a couple of links of
Yeah.
places and she puts in some pictures.
Yeah, but Bouteloua gracilis, the blue grama, is a very attractive grass. And it my experience watching people use it is that if it's irrigated, it looks good in the summer. If it's unirrigated, it goes into a sort of a rough appearance. I do have one challenge on this fire zone plantings. And as much as I try to dig into this and find out what is actually being required, suggested, mandated, you name it, it's extremely confusing. Every district has different rules, has different approaches to this. Not all of those appear to be evidence-based, but that you work with what you got. So I can only tell you a couple of things about grasses. I have some native grasses on my property that I've observed that I think would be possible for you. One of them is the California fescue, Festuca californica. On my property, it naturalizes into the lightly shaded areas. You're closer to Oakland, you're closer to the coast. Full sun is undoubtedly fine with it there. It's an attractive grass. It only gets a couple feet tall for me. One of the things you'll find when you look this one up is some sites will tell you it gets 4 feet tall, which it might do where you are. I don't know. In our area, it tops out at about 2 feet. It seeds itself into areas that are irrigated and also not irrigated. And so I do have the opportunity to test, to look at how it does under those conditions. In full sun, unirrigated, it slowly goes into a summer dormancy, but it still is reasonably attractive. It doesn't go completely to straw. So it doesn't turn into something that would, in and of itself, become a fire hazard. And if you give just one irrigation a month, it actually looks great. It looks fine. It looks like a perfectly normal ornamental grass. So that's Festuca californica. Lots of forms of that out there. Mine is coming up from seed, so I know it is possible for it to do so. Whether you can get the seed that you're after in the quantity you want, I don't know for sure. The other is the wild rye, Elymas, and there's two forms of that. They spread. Okay, this is a sprint plant that spreads vegetatively. It's a native grass. It's on my farm. It was here when we bought the place. I have had years where it's completely unirrigated, looks fine. Years where it's irrigated, looks lush. It spreads even more. So look up Elymus. My guess is you may want to start with plants on that one. I don't know how it how readily it comes up from seed, but it has done well for me. It gets bigger. Elymas condensatus gets to 4 feet. Elymas glaucus 2 feet range. So, and again, that's here. I don't know what they're going to do where you are, where the conditions are milder, perhaps a little more. They might be a little more vigorous where you are. So that's one you might want to use with some caution. But the Festuca californica has done well for me. Also, red fescue in general. Now, Festuca rubra. is worldwide. So if you go to a nursery like mine and buy creeping red fescue, you're not buying our native strain of it by any stretch. You're buying something that was grown in either Oregon or in one case it came in labeled as being from Denmark. It is not, you're not getting your native Festuca rubra if you buy it that way. You should probably buy it locally. You should probably buy it from Hedgerow Farms or Alarner Seed or one of the companies that does locally source native versions of Festuca rubra. Some forms of it have come on the market that are have silver leaf or darker green leaf or more lustrous appearance. Those are available in containers. And they are formed, they're cultivars from coastal zones. One of them is called Patrick's Point. You know, that's easy to remember. That's where it's from. So those are ones you could look for at nurseries if you wanted to give them a try, but you aren't likely to find those from seed. And finally, investigate the Zorro fescue. Zorro. Now that's an annual fescue. So you'd be planting it as an annual cover and it would simply be gone in the summertime. Whether your slope would be stable enough for that, I don't know, because slope plantings are rather different. Seeding these would be done at the beginning of the rainy season. Your biggest issue is going to be them being outcompeted by the non-native grasses. If you've got oats or things like mustard, not a grass, but a very aggressive non-native plant, they're going to shade all these things out. So you'd have to identify what you already have on the site as to whether direct seeding these is likely to be successful. You might test a little area with a drip line. I can see from your picture that this slope goes down from a garden. So if it were mine, there'd probably be a drip line running down at least, 6 or 8 feet below your existing garden, anchored securely to the slope with some plants put in perhaps from seedlings there to see how these do, test them out, see if they work for you, and then either seed more or just keep planting more. I remember helping friends in Lafayette with some planting many years ago, and we developed a technique of running drip along the slope and an emitter near each plant, relatively low output emitter in this case, so that it doesn't run off, so it has a chance to soak in. When you plant the plant, you literally do make almost a little tiny basin for the plant so it gets the water from that dripper. That worked. We were able to plant even ground cover plants. In their case, it was Baccharis that we were using, but you could probably do this with grasses and get them established that way. So if it were mine, I'd probably start with some of these things on a line near where you can manage it and see how they do, see how they look during the summer. Test it a little bit in terms of backing off on the irrigation. The grasses I've mentioned, other than the Zorro fescue, the Festuca californica, the Elymas, would almost certainly be fine with a once a month watering once established to keep them looking reasonably green. The only question I have, would these grasses be acceptable in your area? Whether they would be allowed, whether these intentionally planted grasses would meet the rules of your local fire regulations. And that's the part I really don't have an answer for. But those are a good starting point. And also, the source I mentioned, Hedgerow Farms, has a phenomenal website. Hedgerow Farms is here in Yolo County, but they're part of Larner Seed, a larger seed company that sells locally sourced seed that you can see where they got it. So that you can actually, the provenance of the seed, unlike just going into a nursery and saying, I want some wildflowers and getting some quote wildflower mix, or I want some grasses and getting some fairly random grass mix. You can get exactly what you need. So you could go to Calscape, calscape.org, type in your zip code, figure out which grasses are actually native to your area. Consider ordering some of those. And I would do two things. I'd direct seed some of them, and as most of my customers who really get into this would do, I would plant some of them in pots and figure out a way to carefully plant some of those seedlings out where you can get irrigation to them by hand or by a very simple rudimentary drip system for the first summer or two and get them established that way. Generally speaking, the people I know who are working to establish native grasses find that transplanting them out is way more effective than direct seeding them. I see you have a big area, so I do a combination of these things, but be prepared to spend money on grass seed that's mostly not going to germinate if you're just kind of throwing it out there at the start of the rainy season. Perhaps better to hedge your bets by planting some seedlings out.
And she has gophers. Now, do gophers eat grass that's grown, or do they just eat roots, or do what do gophers eat? They eat seed?
Well, they don't eat seed, all the above. They eat the roots, they do eat young grass plants. So that will be a challenge. And if it turns out to be a real challenge, you may have to do direct planting with gopher baskets, which isn't going to be practical in this area. So, grass, that's the reason I mentioned the Elymas, even though that really does spread rather vigorously. It'll probably recover from gopher damage better than some of the other ones we talked about. You get enough of a population, Stan. I mean, I have gophers on my property. They come up where the Festuca Californica is. They burrow in around it. Helps the water redistribute, I guess. They're not entirely negative, but they will take out a young plant very suddenly, which is frustrating. The one I would mention for other listeners is the deer grass, Muhlenbergia ridgens, which has become one of the most popular of our native grasses in our area because we find we can plant it out. For example, Tree Davis did some landscaping where we planted trees and some California fuchsias and some salvias, and we wanted grass. We planted deer grass, Muhlenbergia ridgens. Plant gets 3 feet across, 3 feet tall, blooms stand up another foot or two above that. So bigger than what they're looking for in this situation. But even unirrigated, it looks pretty good through the summer, and irrigated, it looks great. Very tough, very competitive with a lot of these other things. So if there are a way to put in some of that up closer to the house, I can guarantee deer grass planted out from gallon cans or even 4-inch pots would almost surely survive and get past the gophers at some point and be a real attractive plant.
Oh, Don,
that was
it's
depressing.
June.
Okay.
It's June, and we haven't done the calendar yet.
Okay.
I'm going to read the species names of the pictures on the calendar. And by the way, listeners, you know, you can always go to redwoodbarn.com. And on the front page, there's a link to the calendars. And the June calendar starts with Salvia splendens.
Oh, yes.
I gotta say, is one of the shockingest red colors I've ever seen.
This is funny.
It's so bright.
Okay, we'll stop on that one. Salvia is a huge group. There are now probably 100 different species, cultivars, hybrids out there that you can buy at nurseries. Salvia splendens is the annual sage. It's your scarlet sage. It's the one your grandparents grew. Grew it from seed, stuck it out in the garden because it's pretty. It's fire engine red and very, very easy to grow. Well, we were talking about this at my shop the other day. I pulled out my oldest edition of the Sunset Western Garden book, the one that had a ring binder. Remember that one?
Yeah.
1950s. It had, I think, six salvias total in it.
Oh my, you probably have six pages now.
Roughly, yes, actually, that's just about right. And of the six, there's, you know, common garden sage, the cooking sage, and a couple of species that are native, and then it had Salvia splendens. So that was the original salvia or ornamental sage that people grew for years and years and years. It's funny how it's kind of fallen by the wayside because of all these new shrubby versions and herbaceous perennials. But, you know, annual scarlet sage is one of the most rewarding annuals you can grow here in the summertime. Blooms like crazy, nonstop all the way into the fall. And some of the new ones, like the Texas hummingbird sage, which is just a seedling strain of this one, reseed very happily. I'm happy to see them popping up in different parts of my flower border.
How tall does this get?
Regular Salvia splendens gets about a foot to a foot and a half.
That's the flower spikes, you mean?
The most common that are on the market now. Yes, in full bloom, it's about a foot to a foot and a half tall. Originally, it was about a 3-foot annual. And you can still find those older versions in seed catalogs. Like salvias in general want full sun. Salvia splendens definitely wants full sun. There are some exceptions of ones that can tolerate shade.
All right. Well, the next one is a penstemon, and this one is called Painted Lady.
Yeah.
It has beautiful markings on it, Don.
Yeah, this is one of the garden hybrid penstemons, most of which are 1 to 2 year plants, has been my experience, but they give a lot of bloom in that time. There are exceptions. There's one called Midnight that's been on every top 10 perennial list I've ever written in over 4 decades because it just blooms and blooms and blooms. And my plants typically last 10 or 12 years or more. So Midnight, which is a dark blue, almost purple one, is one of the best garden plants around. Most of these others, they're great for filler, great for a couple of years, and then they tend to peter out.
Well, the next one I'm going to call Morning Glory because I want him to pronounce its Latin name.
Ipomoea.
Yes.
I think we've talked about Morning Glory enough on here. Plant them carefully if you're going to do it at all.
Mandevilla laxa.
That's a Chilean jasmine, which is not a jasmine. And it's not the Mandevilla that most people are thinking of, or Mandevilla. It's a great shade vine, interestingly. My first introduction to this plant was on the north side of the head house where the Botanical Conservancy is, the botany greenhouses, growing in total shade, trained up on a trellis, and it bloomed very nicely there. It also will take a fair bit of sun. This is a hardy Mandevilla. This plant is deciduous, unlike most of the ones that you're seeing in stores. If they have the name Mandevilla on them and they're in a Trader Joe's or someplace like that, and they're red or pink or, you know, those stronger colors, Those are actually Diplodenias, they moved to a different genus, and they are tender. They are not hardy in the USDA Zone 9. I know people who get them through the winter, much as they do with bougainvilleas or hibiscus, but they're not reliably hardy here in the winter. This one is totally hardy. And it's a super fragrant, but not the kind of fragrant that is annoying. You walk up to it to smell it. It's not the kind that overwhelms your house. And for listeners outside the area, I'm going to tell you that it's hardy, according to Sunset Western Garden Book, to Sunset Zone 4.
Wow.
Yeah, down root hardy to 5 degrees. Okay, I didn't know
Wow.
that.
That's
So,
hardy.
yeah.
That's definitely hardy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the next one is a geranium called Johnson's Blue.
Yeah.
And when I say geranium, I do not mean Pelargonium or
No.
Martha Washington's. I mean the real geranium.
Cranesbill. We'll call these
Yeah.
Cranesbills. Now, this is a funny one because I remember in the 1980s when Johnson's Blue Geranium came on the market, and the Sacramento Bee, their CalLife section, featured it. Big picture, the blue flowered geranium, true geranium, not a pelargonium. That's what we call geraniums in the trade are actually pelargoniums. This is a geranium, and they featured this blue geranium. This nobody had it in production at the time. So we
Oops.
got like 30 plus calls. I don't even remember how many special orders we took. There's a blue geranium. Can you get this? I said, well, it'll be available later in the season. You do understand this is not, pelargonium. Yeah. I just want this blue geranium. They finally became available like 3 to 4 months later. One of our growers had them in bloom, and it came in, and we called all these people. I swear, half of them who came said, "That's not, I no, I want a geranium." Said,
That's not a geranium.
this is a
It
geranium. Said,
actually
no,
is.
this
It's a
isn't what I
cranes
want.
bill.
Yeah, they thought someone had come up with a blue pelargonium. Geraniums, cranesbill, it's a big group. There's lots and lots of different kinds. My experience in general is there are plants that don't like to be above about 85 degrees, and they don't like humidity below about 35 or 40%. So they can look rough here if they're in full sun, where they looked fine in April. By June, they can look rather stressed. So if you can plant them, my own experience, this is just anecdotal, where there will be increasing shade as the summer comes along. So the shade of a deciduous tree, like on the edge of that shade, seems to be just about perfect. They're one of those kind of plants. Expect them to look a little rough during extreme high temperature episodes, but they'll come back just fine. So they're like, there's a whole group of plants, in my opinion, that are happiest when it's 55 to 85 degrees, just like us, right? Nasturtiums and patchouli, there's a lot of other plants like that. You get into the high temperature, low humidity episodes that we have here much of our summer, they'll look stressed, but they'll get through it. And as you get into the milder spells in the spring and fall, they'll really come into their own. And Johnson's Blue was the first of this almost true blue category of Cranesbill. The next one that came on is called Roseanne, and that one is even larger flowered and even more trending towards almost true blue. Violet blue is the way I would describe it. Don't put them in full sun here in the Sacramento Valley. Those of you on the coast, these are great plants that can apparently scamper all over your yard. Go into the mailbag there and look at the one from Emily.
I'm growing pumpkins, the jack-o'-lantern variety, for the first time in my raised bed. The female flowers with the small pumpkin buds at the base have been shriveling and falling off. What should I do? For context, the plants look vigorous and healthy, sprawling everywhere. Lots of male flowers are blooming. They're getting watered every day or as needed. The soil has composted steer manure and worm cask amendments. I'm on the foggy Monterey Peninsula, but it hasn't been especially foggy since they've been blooming the past few weeks, and
Yeah,
this came in mid-June.
and pumpkins do very well in coastal climates. I mean, I think about the first places that pumpkins were grown when people started growing giant pumpkins, and it was Nova Scotia, so rather coastal maritime climate. Almost surely the ones that are falling off simply did not get pollinated. That's the most common issue. Even though you have male and female flowers present, pumpkins are pollinated by squash bees. They can be pollinated by other kinds of bees, but the squash bees are particularly effective at it. And so you may not have them present. They are something that like to overwinter in stems of plants that you've cut back or allowed to die off naturally in the flower border, sunflowers, things like that that have hollow stems, places like that. It's quite possible that you just are too cold for them to be active. Although my experience with squash bees, they're the first ones I see active in the day. If I go out there at sunrise, they're out there doing things here, although we're sunny at sunrise. Whereas the European honeybees, they don't even get up until about 10 in the morning. They're very fussy about temperatures and things like that. My guess is it's just lack of pollination. That's the most common issue. You can be the bee. You can take those male flowers, take your finger, rub it on the pollen part. If pollen comes off on your finger, totally cool. Pick off that male flower, walk over, rub it on the female flower, and hopefully you'll get pollination that way. My guess is the plant will do it naturally anyway. You probably have pollinators that will come along and take care of it, but you can certainly facilitate that. You can use a camel's hair brush, or you can just smash the flowers together gently.
And she did say this is the first time she's grown this,
yeah.
And then it's in a new raised bed. So yeah. Maybe they just haven't found it yet. Maybe it'll be cured next year.
Yeah, if you get squash bees in your area, that's great because they're actually really important for pumpkins and melons and cucumbers and things like that. Other bees do pollinate those types of flowers, but if you watch them, they're less effective. And also, my understanding is that the flowers of these are more receptive at certain times of day when the squash bees are likelier to be present. So get up there at sunrise, head on out there, and be the bee.
Be the bee. Would a Q-tip work, Don?
Sure.
All right. Be the bee.
Well, we want to do our annual reminder here. I want to go ahead and do this one now. If you get the Davis Enterprise, my most recent garden column was in the Sunday Davis Enterprise. And I also have now gotten in the habit of turning them into a PDF and uploading them to redwoodbarn.com. So there is one there called June Garden Questions. And while it mostly went through El Nino and the stuff we talked about in the recent show, there is one thing that's in there. You've all heard this before, but the time to discuss it is now, since we've already had the first person come in saying, I think I have whiteflies on my plant. What am I going to do about them? What do you have to spray? And usually starts the conversation with, I already sprayed neem. Okay. Stop spraying stuff. As long as it stops spraying stuff until you know exactly what you're dealing with and what the life cycle is. By the way, neem works okay on white flies, but not great has been our experience.
But I don't want to eat neem.
Well, it's used for that purpose and you can read the label and all that kind of thing. But the smell is a little off-putting. When it first came on the market, we used it in our nursery for white flies. And we all found that the unpleasant smell lingered for about 2 days, which is not a great thing in retail. So one of the simplest practices you can adopt right now to minimize damage in your yard from aphids and whiteflies, but also thrips and mites, is to wash your plants off vigorously every few days. When you're out there in your vegetable garden, your flower garden, you've hand watered the containers, you've done your stuff, put a nozzle on and wash everything off really vigorously. In doing that, you will kill adult stages of at least a couple of those, the aphids and the white flies in particular. You'll dislodge the eggs, particularly the white flies, if you focus on the undersides of the leaves a little bit, and some of the nymphs, and you'll reduce the dust. This is an important part for spider mites. Spider mites will attach themselves on leaves that have a dusty leaf surface. We get a lot of dust here in the valley because this is an agricultural region and we get wind here. And so dust encourages spider mites. And so rinsing off the dust can reduce spider mites. And I have little doubt that to some degree it sets back thrips, although I can't particularly prove that. Providing extra moisture in doing this, people are often worried, like, is it going to make disease problems on the leaves or should I only do it at certain times of day? One, no, it's not in our climate going to make any disease difference on the leaves, because by the middle of the afternoon here, our humidity is so low that any rinsing you've done, even into mid-afternoon, will not cause the spread of diseases. There are places you might be listening where that would be a concern. If you have downy mildew on basil, for example, you know, if you're in that region, then you wouldn't be doing this. But here, it works just fine. Also, the time of day does not matter. We do this at our nursery any time of day we happen to think we have the time to do it. We try to do it early in the day because it's just better not to have everything dripping wet when customers walk in, but midday, early afternoon, or right before we leave also work. It turns out the most common concern with that is people thinking the old myth that water on the leaves will magnify the sun's rays and burn the leaves or somehow damage the plant. Not in our climate and not provably anywhere. That's one of those garden myths that simply will not die, that water droplets on leaves are going to act like little, lenses and burn the leaf. No, this has been tested. I don't know how I would run a nursery if I couldn't water in the afternoon. There just wouldn't be any way to do it. So I can tell you for a fact, that's not an issue. So it doesn't really matter what time of day you do it. If white flies start to increase, this is specific training that we give our staff. You look at the verbenas, the lantanas, fuchsias, if you have them, Certain plants that are known for being breeding sites for white flies, you'll learn what they are in your yard, in your garden, in your nursery, and you just shake them as you walk by. Anything in the mint family is very commonly a host for them. And if adults are fluttering up, staff knows, bring it to our attention. Everybody gets now prepared to get into white fly mode. Rinse those infested plants vigorously at least once a day. Twice a day is fine, for 3 or 4 days in a row. And that's really the key, is the repeated doing it. Because, and I mean vigorously rinse them. I'm not just showering them. You're not just washing off the leaves. You're using a nozzle that makes a stream of water to blast off the leaves. You will not hurt the plants. Most common question, aren't you going to knock all the leaves off? Well, you control the throttle. I mean, I suppose you could with a pressure washer injure the plants, but I've used those and not done it because I control the throttle. Next question, don't they just crawl back up? Well, no, don't think too hard about this, but if their proboscis was in the plant, it stays in the plant and it tears off, and the adults will drown, the nymphs are blown into oblivion, and the eggs detach and desiccate. All that helps. The thing is that there's usually one stage, some of the eggs are harder to get at, and one instar in the case of white flies, it's stuck on better. So that one day rinsing won't take care of every stage of the insect. Beneficial insects, ladybugs, lacewings like that, are big enough to withstand your fire hose. And you are basically trying to reset the population of the pest, the white fly or the aphid. Knock off 80%, 90% of them. Well, the beneficial insects are increasing in a linear manner. They are multiplying, they are increasing, and they will continue to increase in the presence of the pest and with adequate moisture nearby. So the washing off helps to bring them into the area as well. So you're just resetting the population, waiting for the beneficials to come along and catch up and give adequate control. In our nursery, we have found that vigorous rinsing once or twice a day, 3 to 4 days in a row, will knock the population down substantially to the point where we are not actually finding pests present, and there's not been a need to spray in our nursery yard for over 20 years. We haven't used any pesticides on our plants for at least that long because we manage them this way by physically removing them with a strong stream of water. You start that when you first see the adults, and you won't have a problem.
So Don said that it goes through different stages, and one stage might be might not get washed off.
Right.
But understand, the stages are sequential.
Yep.
And so the thing that didn't get washed off is then going to go to the next stage of the insect, and that will be able to be washed off.
Yeah.
So that's why the repeated washings day after day are necessary, because the stages continue. It doesn't stop when you wash them. It just
Yeah.
keeps going.
And aphids have a particular temperature range. Each one has a particular range of temperatures. In the case of aphids, that goes up into the mid-80s. So we start getting into our normal higher temperatures. Aphids level off here. And in fact, by then, the beneficials will give very good control. So in our region, aphids are very much a spring, maybe to early summer problem. And again, they'll show up in the late, in fall, but they're not typically a problem that much for us through the summer. However, white flies have a higher temperature tolerance, a higher temperature range for reproduction. They can go into the 90s. So we tend to start seeing white flies when we've been in the 90s for a few days or even hit 100 degrees. That's when they really start to build up. The other insect group that this works on, by the way, is mealybugs and scale. And you just have to be more vigorous about it because they're really stuck on there in the case of scale. In the case of mealybugs, they're down in the leaf angles and down in the down around the roots, for example, at least on the top portion of the roots. And so it's harder to get at them. But if you're diligent and really vigorously rinse them, and I mean really strong blast of water in the case of scale, you can get very good control with them as well. None of the insecticides you're thinking of work real well on these anyway. I mean, most of them are either oils like neem or like a refined oil that people might use, horticultural oils, we call them. Well, they do. They smother the insects you spray them on, but unfortunately, above about 85 degrees, they'll also burn the foliage of the plant you just sprayed. So there's a real risk of causing leaf burn or phytotoxicity while you're trying to control the insects. Most of the common insecticides simply don't give very good control. I've managed white flies in a greenhouse where they have less than a 3 week population generation turnover, and we use some pretty high power stuff in there, and they were still our number one pest. So I think the mechanical control obviously is much safer for you, better for your yard in general. And my observation over many years of managing this as a nursery pest is it has better efficacy. So physically blasting them off and encouraging beneficials is your best long-term strategy for aphids and especially white flies. Also keep in mind, as we always like to tell you, dragonflies love to eat white flies. So do whatever you can to draw dragonflies to your garden, which can be as simple as putting a little water feature out there, and you'll see them out there in the early evening, flying around and feeding on adult whiteflies.
And they like to sit on the top of twigs where they can oversee the water, or on the antenna on your car if you happen to have an old-fashioned antenna. Dragonflies are beautiful.
They like bamboo.
We have some gorgeous ones.
They really like bamboo. I have a lot of clumps of bamboo, and they like the fact that there's twiggy things for them to sit on. And bamboo with a water source nearby is a lovely and very natural combination. If you're concerned about bamboo, go to redwoodbarn.com and read one of my many articles on the topic of bamboo and just choose the right variety.
So, Don, why do you have so many articles on bamboo?
Well, my parents were very involved in the American Bamboo Society. Yeah. Many years ago in the 1980s, my father was escorting my mother around San Diego where she was selling succulents to nurseries down there. She had started, we opened our nursery and she got interested in something that had interested her years before. And she started propagating succulents and she took some flats of them down to Walter Anderson Nursery. You all know that one if you're in San Diego. And they bought everything she had. She was thrilled. I remember that conversation. I went there, they bought everything in the car. Yeah, they'll do that. Go back again in a few weeks. They probably will. So she started propagating succulents and taking them to the different nurseries. And I said, well, Dad, while you're there, I can't find any clumping bamboos here in Northern California, the kind that we really recommend, the Golden Goddess and that type. But everybody up here has running bamboo. See if you can find, you know, they're driving up to see us a couple times a year. See if you can find some clumping bamboos. And my father was someone who didn't do things by half measures, as we say. So the next thing we knew, he was, oh, there's a bamboo society here in San Diego. Oh, I'll get involved in the bamboo society. Oh, okay, I'll get involved. Sure, I'll be president of the chapter. Okay, I'll be president of the American Bamboo Society. So he went from looking for a few bamboo for me to being president of the American Bamboo Society for at least a couple of years. My mom and I edited their magazine for a decade, and I did it for another 7 years after that. So I was really involved in that organization. If you're looking for information about the right kind of bamboo to plant anywhere, bamboo.org has what you need. Yes, I have lots of articles because of my involvement with the Bamboo Society. You'll find that at redwoodbarn.com. Bamboo for the Sacramento Valley, for example, which ones we recommend here. It's a big topic. Wherever you're listening, there is a bamboo you can grow. The furthest north I know of is bamboo being grown in Norway. So it is possible to grow the right species, the right variety, wherever you're listening. And you also want to make sure you don't plant the ones that become very problematic. So there's lots of information at redwoodbarn.com and lots of information at bamboo.org.
And Don sends me pictures sometimes. This time it is titled Echinacea. And I opened it. Boy, that thing is spectacular. It is a shocking orange red.
Yeah.
And then in the middle, there's this, well, it looks like a green and gold porcupine. I mean, well, you may not be, well, that most people wouldn't be familiar with what a porcupine looks like. So
I don't encounter them very often, no.
No, not out here. But it's just gorgeous. And the leaves, I mean, the petals at the outside are recurved down. Now, is this a flower inflorescence, or is this actually a flower?
Oh, this is an inflorescence. It's a classic daisy. So what you're seeing there is the tiny flowers that attract have the pollen and do all the stuff, and the ray of generally sterile flowers around the outside that have the showy petals that draw in the pollinator.
The ray flowers.
Yeah. Yeah. And right. These are Echinacea. It is best known to most people as cone flower, Echinacea purpurea. There's been a lot of cultivars of Echinacea introduced over the years, and a fair bunch have come on in recent years. And I'm always really skeptical when anything gets improved and is dwarfer, because that's just the nature of our industry. Make it shorter, make them all bloom at once. And then my question is, do they keep blooming? You know, is this a one and done, or is this something that keeps blooming? And how perennial are these? Since the plant you're starting with is technically sold as a biennial, to call its derivatives a perennial might be a little bit misleading. The Cheyenne Spirit seed strain of Echinacea that came on the market a couple decades ago is really, really good. And it's got these strong colors, orange, yellow, red. It's a seed strain. So it's not a clonally propagated thing. You're not getting a division of a division of a division of a division. You get some variability in this strain. It was introduced for the new color range that it introduced, the yellow and the orange, which was new at the time. But what we found is it's really delightful because you'll get this whole range of colors, and they come back. This plant is 3 years old, so it is actually blooming into its third year. And you do get the as I say, the mix of colors, a mix of heights. This plant's only about a foot tall, but some of the Cheyenne Spirit series get taller than that. It's a great one to look for. I'm really concerned about echinaceas and rudbeckias and the amount of heavy breeding that's being done on them, the use of plant growth regulators in the nursery industry to make them branch more heavily from the base and bloom shorter and all at once. To me, that's selling people a bouquet, not a garden plant. And it takes a while for some of these plants to outgrow the impact of that those plant growth regulators. I'm seeing this on Monardas, bee balm. I'm seeing it on Echinacea. I've always seen it on Rudbeckias because they're too rangy for the nursery business. You know, we don't like things that bloom 16 inches tall or 18 inches tall. We want them all 8 inches tall. Well, gardeners want them to be garden plants. So if you're looking at Echinaceas, stick with Magnus, the original bigger flowered pink version. Alba, the white one, good long-lived garden plant. Cheyenne Spirit looks like a very good strain, as it has been a very good strain for me as well. Any of the newer ones, try them, see how they do, you know, and give them 2 or 3 years and see whether they come back and how well they perform. But be aware that sometimes the breeding goals are different than what you as a gardener might be after.
It's June. It's almost the end of June. What are you harvesting now? What are you planting now?
I've just harvested some tomatoes that got past the turkeys, and I'm harvesting cucumbers and squash are both being harvested now. So these are plants that I put in 4 weeks ago. So if you're still looking for something to plant in your summer vegetable garden, cucumbers and squash will produce less than a month after putting the plants in the ground. You can also, of course, still plant tomatoes. You can still plant peppers. I've got about a dozen peppers sitting in gallon cans waiting for me to decide exactly where they're going to spend the rest of the season. There's still lots of things you can plant. I do highly recommend, if you're into basil, plant new plants of basil every 2 to 4 weeks, right on through the summer until about the 1st of September, and you'll have a nice steady crop of regular Genovese basil. So that's something you can certainly be putting in now as well. And I'm about to plant another hibiscus roselle. If you haven't grown that one, I suggest that you grow it just for a beautiful plant and then enjoy the flowers, or technically the sepals, the calyces of the flowers for hibiscus tea. It's a beautiful plant, grows rapidly to about 6 feet, looks like a shrub by September. October, it comes into full bloom. They're little hibiscus flowers. They're very, very pretty. And that is the kind that you use for tea. Roselle hibiscus goes in when the soil is warm, anytime late May through June and into July. Hey, Charlie, quick note. We got your message with a question about a peach tree, and we'll talk about that next week.
So today we have a quote from Luther Burbank, and it is, "Flowers always make people better, happier, and more helpful. They are sunshine, food, and medicine for the soul."
Luther Burbank was an American plant breeder who developed, according to Wikipedia, more than 800 strains and varieties of plants over his 55-year career. Mostly worked with fruits, flowers, grains, grasses, and vegetables. He's probably best known for the Shasta daisy, which he literally created, okay? The July Alberta peach, the Santa Rosa plum, the Wixen plum, and of course the russet Burbank potato. So he had a big impact on your life without you necessarily even knowing who Luther Burbank was. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.